My name is Linda Bergsma. I am an assistant professor at the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health in at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona. And I have also been with the Arizona Rural Health Office for a very long time, it seems, since 1987. So my, you know, public health is population health. Well, the population that I focus on most is rural populations. So let me get started here. Well, let's look a little bit at rural mental health needs, and you may be aware of this, but then again you may not, because there hasn't been a real focus on rural mental health that much, and so I'm trying to lead a little more focus around the country on rural mental health. 62 million people live in rural areas of the U.S., or around 20% of the population. As you can see these figures, so in Arizona this means that we've we've got about 300,000 rural people that need good behavioral health care, and our publicly funded behavioral health clients die an average of almost 32 years sooner than the general population, while the average is 25 years of potential life lost by individuals with serious mental illness. In 2008, the National Rural Health Association, of which I'm a member and on their policy congress, and was just thinking to myself that this whole presentation should happen also at the National Rural Health Association annual meeting. On a policy paper that I worked on and with a team of others, we stated that leadership is critically needed to develop comprehensive policies that account for rural realities, and they don't result in these smaller, kind of under-resourced versions of urban programs. Now, it's not just rural behavioral health that this happens to. It's all health care. When you take a policy and a good idea that works in urban areas and you just say, well, okay, we'll just kind of do it smaller in rural areas, it doesn't work. And so also there's this tendency to seek these single black and white kind of solutions to a panoply of issues that affect the provision of quality care, and there are no simple single policy solutions, unfortunately, in the complex world of healthcare in rural areas. There is an organization called the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health, which we call NOSOR. I think the SOR part is really kind of interesting. Anyway, they published a few years ago an assessment toolkit that was done by the Maine Rural Health Research Center that actually focuses a lot on rural behavioral health. And this toolkit was to assist state offices of rural health to understand their behavioral health care systems, for one thing, to identify health planning or policy initiatives that may be in place, explore opportunities for the SOARs to partner with key behavioral health stakeholders and elevate the visibility of rural behavioral health policy issues. I am trying to do that with you and other people, and then identify opportunities for these state offices of rural health to engage in kind of collaborative initiatives to improve quality and delivery. So these were written in this toolkit, and when I read them, I said, wow, that's exactly what I would like to do in the state of Arizona. I mean, I didn't have to write my own goals and purposes for this study that we did. And we used the toolkit, but we adapted it in many ways. And it was designed to be flexible and adaptable depending on the state situation. So we decided we wanted to do a review of the rural behavioral health care in Arizona. And we looked at it and we said, well, there's a lot of different kinds of rural behavioral health care. There's the public behavioral health care system, which is basically the Medicaid behavioral health care system that is funded through what we have in Arizona called the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, which is a mnemonic that this basically says access. But there's also private insurance for rural behavioral health people, and then there's VA, rural behavioral health, got a lot of VA folks in rural, and then there's IHS in in Arizona because we've got a lot of Native American tribal areas. And then there's rural prison behavioral health because we have a lot of rural prisons. So we decided, well, let's start at least with the public behavioral health care system, thinking that the population group in that system would probably be the largest. But we've got a lot of work to do with some more studies, as you can see. So the study methodology was fairly simple, a qualitative study. We did some interviews with key informants. We did a focus group with six rural behavioral health providers at FQHCs. We did an extensive review of a lot of online documents, and that was very helpful. There was a lot of good stuff online, although it really needed sorting through, and it's kind of like detective work. Really needed a lot of fine work, and so I want to actually thank my team of people who did the work with me, a couple of student MPH research assistants, and on and on. So that we did. We took all this data that we had and did the analysis to determine the report content and the recommendations. We wrote the report and then actually passed the report by the key informants that we had interviewed so that we could say, you know, did we get this right? Because the key informant interviews were, they were structured interviews, but there was lots of room for probes and things like that. So we got a lot of stuff that didn't always, one group didn't kind of maybe agree with another one and so on. So we tried to figure out what was really going on here. So we thought it was really important that they had a chance to review it. And we also passed it by four other people who we felt had some good information about the behavioral health care system that they could help us review the report. Well, let's see. The study challenges. Well, over this 1 year period that we actually did the study and wrote the report, we were studying a tremendously rapidly moving target. It's like it changed every 5 minutes. And as we interviewed one person, and then we might interview another person 2 weeks later, they would say, oh yeah, but there's just been this happening, and then there's going to be this happening. And the state was slashing budgets like crazy. This year alone, before the report came out, they slashed all budgets through Medicaid 5%, and then in October they did it. That was in April. Then in October they did another 5%. So it's just going on and on. Also, the Mental Health Parity Act came along and was kind of, you know, it was first of all the regulations were there, then when is it going to be implemented, and then it was finally implemented, but nobody really knew during the study exactly how that implementation, what it was going to really mean in many ways, although they had ideas. And then another thing is that we have a managed care kind of plan in which the state contracts with what we call regional behavioral health authorities to coordinate and manage behavioral health care in regions of the state, geographic service areas of the state. The regional behavioral health authorities re-up every 3 years or so with these contracts. And we had a very unhappy situation during the time we were doing this, where one regional behavioral health authority had lost, it had an urban area that it covered, but it also had a large rural area in South and Eastern Arizona, and it lost its contract. And another group was given the contract for that place. Well, the one that lost the contract said, no, you can't do this. We're going to question this, and we were going to take this to court and so on. So they did, and all kinds of things were going on. So the poor people and the poor providers and the people that some of these people that we interviewed who were in southeastern rural Arizona had no idea what was going on, and certainly the consumers had no idea what was going on. Were they going to still have their same provider? Well, I mean, it was really bad news for about 6 months until the original regional behavioral health authority withdrew their complaint, and finally it went from July, when it should have happened and the transfer should have happened, to mid-December before anybody knew exactly who was going to take over that that management of that area. Okay, the other thing was our need as a state rural health office and a state entity to provide balanced perspectives while clarifying the rural inequities. And this was at the time that we sent this out for review, we did have some people who said, well, we don't think you should say it like this. We think you should say it like this. And we had to make some decisions along the way of where we felt we had the right information, we had an accurate perspective, and we weren't going to mince words too much. Okay, we were careful, but we were as straightforward as we possibly could be to say the things that we needed to say. And I can tell you, both good and bad about our system. There's a lot of good things about our system. So the resulting 45-page document reports ways that the rural behavioral health system is working well and where there are challenges and opportunities for improvement, including 9 action recommendations that we made. This is a table of contents. Basically, we had an introductory section and then a whole section on the management and delivery of behavioral health services, a section on prevention and treatment. Very obviously, we needed a section on integration of behavioral and physical health, because that another thing that was kind of a moving target was that the head of our Arizona Department of Health Services made this right toward sort of just after we started the program, started to make this a major priority of his and started pulling people together around more integration, for which we are very delighted. And then a section on the recommendations and thank yous, etc. Of course, there's an alphabet soup of every kind of thing in our state, and I've heard so many of these acronyms over the years but didn't really understand them all. I have to tell you that one of the reasons that I needed to do this is since 1987, I've said, the mental health system in our state makes no sense to me whatsoever. I don't understand it at all. And after trying to figure it out for 20 years, I thought to myself, if I don't understand it, I'll bet you there's a whole lot of other people out there who don't. So it will just help me help others if I do, and my staff and the office does. We looked at the funding amounts and the funding streams, of course, and looked at, we're able to find the behavioral health funding, the public behavioral health funding for fiscal year 2010. And these are a few quotes that we got where the first one was that Arizona divides their money between physical and mental health, and that goes against treating the whole person. And we have done that. We have carved those two out so much over the years since the whole Regional Behavioral Health Authority kind of program started. But now there's a lot of interest in integrating. And so I think that we're starting to deal with it, with getting around all of those regulations that have provided and supported those carve-outs. We do have a coordinated system of behavioral health, including mental health and substance abuse. And so we don't talk about mental health services in Arizona. We talk about behavioral health, which is a coordinated system of mental and substance abuse. And it is fairly well coordinated. It's not like never the twain shall meet. We are ahead of many states in our embrace of the concept of community treatment. Very few residents are served in institutions. And the focus is on a recovery that emphasizes hope and meaningful social contribution and independent living, the kind of thing that you were talking about, as opposed to getting rid of symptoms. The problem for rural is that while it is great if people can be treated within the community and within their own families and kept within their own families, there are a lot of rural folks who are ill-equipped to have a mentally unhealthy person within their family. Yet there are no places where they can go for even any kind of respite, let alone short-term residential treatment. There are very, very few places for adults and practically none for adolescents. Challenges. We've had incredibly high leadership turnover since 1993. We've had 9 different directors of the Arizona Department of Health Services and 7 different directors of the Division of Behavioral Health Services. So this really interferes with any kind of planning and any kind of consistency, and everything is proactive. Everything is not proactive, it's really reactive. The hiring freeze since 2008 has meant that there's a 37% vacancy rate in the Division of Behavioral Health Services. The ongoing budget crisis I've already mentioned, with the cuts and then more cuts. The Division of Behavioral Health Services overall budget and funds for non-access eligible, because there is a budget for those who are not eligible for those Medicaid dollars, has been reduced by 50% since 2008. People on the not on the access rolls and budget reductions have a disproportionate effect on rural, and that disproportionate effect is one of the things I talked about, how they end up in rural hospitals that are totally unprepared to take care of them, and they end up in prisons and jails. This was one of the quotes that we got from one of the interviews that we did. And so then the other thing that's happened, even though in 2014 they have to be back on the rolls, Arizona has just cut all people off the access rolls who do not have dependent children. So a lot of young people, age 18 and over, not working or working at very low-paying jobs, and they have no health care, not just mental health care. So these are the recommendation themes that we came up with. The behavioral health penetration and care enrollment penetration rates are very low. There's a whole lot of people out there who weren't enrolled when we started and therefore weren't getting health care, are now automatically enrolled if they're on access but still aren't getting behavioral health care. The integration of behavioral and physical health, which we talked about. Overriding theme was rural behavioral health workforce issues. We're in a terrible problem in health workforce all the way across the board. And urban is in the trouble, but rural is double trouble. I mean, whatever's happening in rural is happening in spades. In urban is happening in spades in rural. The contract transfer management issues, this issue of people not knowing what was going on, that's very bad and needs to be addressed. The continuing state budget reductions. Prevention, there's a plethora of groups out there doing prevention programs, some of which are well known by the Division of Behavioral Health Services, but a whole lot that are not. And so coordination is very, very difficult. Lots and lots of the left hand having no idea what the right hand's doing within the same counties or communities. Many of these rural prevention programs that are not being done under the auspices of the Division of Behavioral Health Services are not being adequately evaluated, so we have no idea what's going on with them, if they're working, why are we doing it? I mean, I can tell you about things like teen mazes that they do to prevent teen pregnancy, for example, and a county that I love those people, but they have never evaluated it. And their adolescent pregnancy rates are very high. And so I finally had to say to them in the gentlest way I could, have you ever at least tracked those people who go through the teen maze to see whether their adolescent pregnancy rates are a little lower, because then it means it's working? And no, we never have. And it's not because they don't want to. They know they should, but they're overworked and underpaid and understaffed, and they don't have most of their staff are not even equipped to do those kinds of evaluations. And that's a workforce issue, a public health workforce issue. Lack of behavioral health residential treatment facilities, to talk about that. And then finally, the final action is to put together a collaborative initiative in the state, which I hope our office will be able to lead. We are in the process of getting this report distributed and starting to talk to a whole lot of people about putting a collaborative effort together to go after some of these recommendations and for action. And we tried really hard not to just make recommendations that took a whole lot of money, because we tried to be really realistic about what we could recommend given today's economic climate. So we've looked at things that that would build on models that are already there, all kinds of different things like that, as opposed to, you know, brand new initiatives. Speaking of dissemination, the report is available for downloading online, but it is also, I do have some printed copies. If any of you are the kind of person who would like to have a printed copy, there are about 9 over there. So, well, there's 10 actually. You can have this one too. So the first come, first serve. They're sitting over there on the side. And I will tell you that this is the first report like this that I know of in the country. Several other state offices of rural health, well, a few other, have actually looked at, yes, please feel free to get up and go. I can talk while you're there, and then when you're back, we'll take questions. A few other state offices of rural health have actually looked at doing this and have collected some data, but have not actually been able to put the report together. And I have to tell you, there was so much data that we had, it was my continuing nightmare that we would actually never get this report produced, but we did. So thank you very much for your time, and I'll take any questions. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. It happened in October. Around 80,000 or so, 82,000, I believe, people in the state. 80 to 100,000.
If those people are the authentic clusters, what's going
to happen? I don't know. They're going to end up going to emergency rooms of hospitals and to prisons and jails. And those folks are not the only folks who are not eligible for the public. And there's all these working poor that this gentleman was talking about. There's a whole lot of people in our state who have no health care insurance whatsoever. Yes, we have a good system of federally qualified health centers, and they do have a sliding fee scale. And so people are able to go there, and people do, okay? But they are not well known by anyone for their mental health or behavioral health care that they give. There are a couple of them that are providing more and more of it, and they're, when they get people coming in for physical care and the primary care physician thinks this person has a comorbidity mental health problem, then that physician will refer them to the person who's there. But that's a very small number at this point. Yeah.
What can we do? Since the whole push right now is to emphasize the capacity of the federal qualified health centers of the local what can we do as a mental health topic though to let people know about the accuracy and the mental health work that they can provide to our population?
Well, I think what you probably ought to do is be working with the National Association of Community Health Centers and looking at how many community health centers, FQHCs, out there actually do provide mental health services. And then the other thing is that a lot of them don't provide mental health services because there are blockages in licensure and other regulations that prevent them from getting paid for it. So those blockages have to be reduced also. And in our state, that's what's happening. The licensure things are changing. And, of course, that's because the head of our Department of Health Services says this is what's going to happen. He's got the clout and the power to do it. Yes?
Well, along that line, the National Association of Community Health Centers, did a report that released in December of 2010 that surveyed all of the FQHDs to see, and only about 20% of
exactly.
what they call behavioral health, which is mostly mental health and not addiction. So that's the thing. Besides contacting NAC, though, I would urge people to contact their state primary health care association, because everything is playing out so much at the state level. But really looking at working with the Behavioral Health, the Coalition for Whole Health, the people that are speaking for our services, and is really critical. The essential benefits is like, without that starting point, it's all downhill after that. So it's very important to plug in and work with other sections in APHA working on the same thing.
Yes, it's very important. But here's some things I would suggest you do. Number one, get to know your state office of rural health. There is one in every state. Our state office of rural health happens to be at a university level. There are only about 12 to 15 that are in universities. All the rest of them are in state health departments. So get to know your state office of health, state office of rural health people, because they are supposed to be able to provide coordination and put people together to make things happen. Okay, that's a big piece of what we do, is try to be knowledgeable about what's going on in the state and put people together to make things happen. So get to know them. Get to know the people at your primary care association also, and your primary care organization, because those folks also are going to be looking more and more at integration. There's a whole lot of education that has to be done so that people understand that integration is the way to go, and especially the way to go in rural, even more than in urban. Yes?
I was wondering, there is a grant that you should, a year ago come out with a center with Samsung and CareSA. It's called the Center for Integrated Care Solutions.
Mm-hmm.
It provides training and technical assistance to both community centers and community mental health centers.
Mm-hmm.
To integrate, I think that'd be a good resource for all of us to be involved and work together with them. That's a center
already granted a year ago. Just one other thing that I want to add about Arizona. We have a very strong history since the late 80s of using lay health workers or community outreach workers, or in Arizona we tend to call them promotoras, which is health promotoras de salud, because a lot of them are Hispanic. And there are very few of them working in the behavioral health care system. And that's one of the models we would like to promote, and have more outreach workers, lay outreach workers, to help take away some of the stigma involved, and to help identify people who are living in isolated rural areas who really need health care. So that's another piece of what we might be looking at to try to get people into integrated care. Yes?
Question. It might be changing the topic a little bit, but I'm from Montana and worked in a community mental health center for a couple of years as a provider. And, I was struck by kind of looking at these different outcomes and assessing that. You were talking about that a little bit, and whether people are employed, whether they're moving up, whether there's symptom reduction or not is not necessarily what we're looking at. And, for example, in our state, we have such a huge homeless population that it feels to me like there's this question of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and how can we look at outcomes like that without first addressing that you have a seriously mentally ill person who has nowhere to live? And is there anything in this kind of health care bill provisions that addresses that fundamental problem?
So there's two things. One, the new Medicaid state plan amendment for health homes recognizes the need to coordinate different types of care, including social services and housing and so on. So some of that money can be used to do that type of coordination. So I would look at that announcement as an opportunity to expand some of the services that are needed to do the outreach. In addition to that, there needs to be more work on lobbying the social services that are wraparounds to health reform, because health reform per se is about health reform. It is not about social wraparounds. So we are already lobbying that issue on the Hill, saying if you don't pay attention to these social wraparounds, health reform is not going to be as successful as it might otherwise be for exactly the reason you say. If you're living under a bridge somewhere, how can I expect you to have very good health to begin with? I just couldn't expect it, even if you had no conditions.
It's a very serious issue, basically. Yeah. Our families living in cars
or wherever. Yes, absolutely. So we agree. And another thing I'll send around is the statement we developed on social wraparound services, which I think addresses what you're talking about.
We did a small study on rural veterans and homelessness in rural areas because rural areas don't tend to get quite as much homelessness that's obvious as urban areas, but there's a lot of rural veterans in that are living homeless and need to get into health. And right in their community is one of these community outreach centers from the VA and everything. They're not going to go there.
No, I mean, in the city that I'm in, Missoula, Montana, which is 80,000 people, we have one shelter, and it doesn't accept families, no children. Mm-hmm. And there's nowhere for them to go.
Yep.
And veterans generally don't go there. And so we have a huge population of them with the homeless.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
There's a question to both you and Dr. Sandishan. And I've raised this earlier, but I'm still not clear about it. It seems to me in the face of Medicaid expansion that optional services are more at peril as the states look at, you know, the job they're going to have to do vis-a-vis the expanded population. The optional, I mean, some states are abandoning optional services now. So if you say someone with schizophrenia now is getting off sort of the array of services that we identify as sort of core folks with schizophrenia, in 2014, couldn't that all go away as states say, wait a minute, we have to cover the basic.
No, again, two levels here. So in the Medicaid expansion in 2014, 100% of the cost is going to be paid for by the federal government. So the states cannot make the argument, oh my God, we have to move money from here to there. That is not true. That's a falsehood.
That's for the newly insured.
That's for the newly insured.
That's right.
Now, for the currently insured, where they're having problems now, yes, they are cutting back, basically. And that's a serious issue that needs to be lobbied, but it will not be because of the insurance expansion.
No, we agree. There are two parallel tracks there, basically.
That's right. Right. The people in the old system essentially will have to Rolls Royce. They'll be able to go to the community mental health
center.
Yeah, well, that's an issue that needs more political work. Yeah.
So in 2014, when the maintenance of effort requirements end, then states with budget shortfalls can say, let's hack out these optional services.
Right. Because they can't cut people. They can cut the optional services.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, might there not be a scenario where everyone drops to what would be the basic. And that
that's nearsighted and penny-wise and pound foolish, because if you don't pay it that way, you will pay it in other ways. You'll pay it through your criminal justice system, which is what's happening already. Mm-hmm. Part of the expansion of the criminal justice system in the jails is due to the cutbacks of Medicaid at the state levels that have already occurred.
But in our state, the criminal justice system is a major for-profit organization, and they want the business. They're building jails like crazy. And we have a state senator who's in bed with the criminal justice system prisons in our state. And so all of these things that are happening in our state are directly related to the fact that they want to fill up their prisons.
What you keep asking is, I think what the community mental health centers fear greatly is that you could wake up and if you listen to the conversation around here, there's a lot of focus on, is primary care going to do this? Are the federally qualified community health centers going to do this? And what the federally qualified community health centers, when I work with them, what they do is they'll do groups, they'll do individual counseling if they're really ambitious, and they'll monitor medication. And you can imagine somebody that if the community mental health center closes down and they're told this, and you can go over to the federal qualified community health center for your services, you'll get over there, and in best case scenario, they'll say, we can see you in a group, and we can monitor your medication. That's not supported housing, it's not supported employment, it's It's not case management, it's not ACT, it's not any of the other services, which are all the optional services.
Right.
I think that continues to be the problem is people talk about behavioral health and they don't differentiate when they're talking about seriously mentally ill.
Yes.
You know, because
yes.
It's very easy for people to do that, you know, short depression screen in a private, in a primary care setting. And I think that it's kind of like with cancer. You can't say cancer is cancer is cancer because it's not. And the same thing with behavioral health. And I think a lot of times we're going to need people that are speaking to the policymakers to make sure they understand is, you know, we're dealing with very dangerous people. Our state was also behind in the deinstitutionalization, and they're danger to themselves and others, but there's no more ability for them to be housed in an institution. Some of them should be.
We have this issue in Arizona, and those FQHCs in Arizona that are providing behavioral health in integration with, they are not providing behavioral health for SMI patients. They don't even want SMI patients there in their waiting rooms.
I know that.
Can you imagine, and you know, there's a lot of talk about primary care physicians. All of us have a primary care physician, right? Can you imagine having case of schizophrenia and relying on your primary care physician for the coordination of your services, that person wouldn't know what to do with you. And they'd want you out of their office.
Another option here is for behavioral health entities to become federally qualified health centers,
yeah, that was,
or FQHC lookalike.
But that was part of the initial bill in health care reform, and it was not included in the final
version. No, you can't become a behavioral health federally qualified center. That's different than becoming an FQHC as a behavioral health entity.
But the community mental health centers are going to have a very difficult time hiring up all the people that they're going to need to meet the license.
Example, I cited in Michigan. I have an example in Michigan where one of our centers, our county operations, became an FQHC.
Which county did you go?
I'm going to have to thank all of you, and you're welcome to keep discussing, but I want to let people know.
It's gratifying that there's so much interest.
Absolutely.